Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We gather around our kitchen table once a week to talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. And we are here at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames, Iowa, the center of Ames, center of Iowa, the center of everything. Good. It's summer, Donna.
Summertime, 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 summertime.
Thank you.
Summertime.
Good. Good. A short garden update here. We got an unexpected dump of rain. Well, not unexpected. This happens when a
dump
nice
it was
dump
too.
Of rain
it
yesterday.
Poured.
My goodness. My goodness. And the garden is popping up. I've been having trouble with deer. And well, I always have trouble with all sorts of animals.
But Bambi,
But
innocent
they jump over
things,
everything.
Yeah.
They've been nibbling my okra plants. Well, I like okra too, but
pruning.
I had some small ones coming up. I planted a bare spot, and they took care of those real quick. So they've been eating my okra. They found a couple of my pole beans, which leaves the pole beans looking awful because there's this pole there and the beans are gone. But
you have deer fencing? You do.
We do, but deer fencing has to be like 7 or 8 feet high, and we have some, but there are so many holes, and they can pretty much get in anywhere.
Well, they know where to go, I guess. Huh?
Well, actually, and they get used to us. I find them right by my back kitchen door sometimes. It's amazing little things.
So well, they're beautiful. Looking.
Okay, that's what I say. Oh, they're
some
beautiful.
Some statuary things.
Also, they're nibbling on my ends of my tomato plants, too. I can tell because
really?
Nothing is that tall. I mean, it's about 4 feet off the ground, along about my nose level, and they'll just walk down and, okay, so.
Deer height, yeah.
Yeah. So I've got this, and it seems to be working. I figure, let's cover these things with something.
Do they come at night?
Yes. It's something that does not smell good, okay? So I came up with this concoction, looking up on the internet of rotten eggs.
That one I'd heard of.
And mix it with some milk and let that kind of rot too. That's really yummy. And grind up some garlic in that and grind up a little bit of cayenne pepper in there.
The pepper might do it, huh?
Yeah.
But every time it rains, you have to reapply.
Yeah, but I've got this little jar of stuff that I... So there, we're trying. I don't mind sharing, but good heavens, dear, go eat something else for a while. So it's always nice to share things in your garden.
Do you think your dog would stay out in the garden one night? That would surprise them.
Oh, we've tried that.
No.
He just finds his way back to the house and sleeps on
okay,
the porch.
So the deer fence also does not keep the dog in, right?
Well, no. He snorkels back. And Yeah. Well, actually, one thing that does, and my husband Joe's employing this, we leave a radio out in the garden under a bucket so it doesn't get rained on. Tune to KHOI all night. And that seems to actually...
KHOI 89.1 Deer Repellent. All right.
We're trying everything.
All right.
Because,
a new
you know,
use for community radio.
A little bit of noise out there and something that doesn't taste good. It seems to be working. Ah, the joys of gardening. Well, one thing about summer... This is the time to remember to hydrate. Donna's going to talk about drinking things today.
Oh, yeah. It's been warm out. I mean, we know we should hydrate all the time, right? You can't... According to some people, there's no such thing as drinking too much water, right? But you get a little tired of water, water, water. And one thing about summer, being extremely hot does remind you to drink more fluids because you're sweating and, you know, respiring and all of that sort of thing. So I was thinking about that I actually have a routine that I do this every summer. I always buy and have in the house a big seedless watermelon.
Oh.
You know, so you cut it open and I take... I know there's this thing about how seedless watermelon does not have the same flavor as the real old-fashioned seeded one, you know, where you're eating it outside and you're spitting the seeds at your, you know, 10-year-old friends and stuff like that. But if you're making smoothies out of them and you don't want to pick the seeds out, the seedless ones are the way to go. So, you know, this time of year, all the supermarkets have big bins of watermelon for not too much money, right? So I keep one in the house and I take a big slice of it, cut the skin off, and then I put it in chunks into the blender with water. Now, you can make it straight like that, or watermelon is really good if you put something acidic in it, even as basic as lemon juice, or lately I've been sort of really thrilling myself with cherry juice in it. The other thing, of course, is you can make gazpacho, which is a tomato watermelon mixture. But even as a beverage, a tomato, because we're not there yet with the glut of tomatoes, but we will be getting there. So I probably drink one of these major, you know, like maybe I drink a quart of this a day sometimes. And, you know, once you start the watermelon, you know, then you put the rest of it in the refrigerator because the fruit flies go insane, right? And also other melons are good too. Like, okay, this is not an everyday thing, but cantaloupe and vanilla ice cream smoothie, if you've got really ripe melons, is very nice. All of the melons make a good smoothie. The little trick I have, of course, is you have to get, if you chunk the watermelon up, it doesn't always go to the bottom of the blender. So I have an old, it's either a potato mesh or something, like a wooden thing that I smush it down in, and you have to add water or liquid or, you know, something, and then something acid. So I drink a lot of those. They're fast, they're easy, and they're very refreshing. And you can add ice if you want. I don't drink a lot of super cold or a lot of super hot, but that's just a personal preference. Lots of people like them with ice, but I don't consider them a smoothie because they don't have any protein in them or anything. They're just like a blended mm-hmm. fruit drink. And they're very, very refreshing.
Well, three cheers for watermelon. I think watermelon is just a wonderful thing in the summer.
Yeah, it's one of the easiest fruits to deal with because, you know, like cherries have pits, lots of fruit has to be peeled. You know, this one you just get out your butcher knife and whack, 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 boom, into the blender and there it goes. So it's really, even if you just add a squirt of fresh lemon juice or lime. Lime and watermelon is a Mexican thing.
Ha!
So it's very good if you're having taco night. That's the other thing. Now, the other thing that I drink quite a lot of is iced coffee or chicory. Or coffee chicory. Now, chicory is something that I found in France. It's a root of the chicory flower. It is often used as a coffee substitute. I like it on its own because I don't drink that much coffee. But mixed with coffee, it's really good. Or on its own. And I drink it with a lot of milk. So I can drink a big, 12 or 14-ounce glass of that just down the hatch really easy. And then the other one that I drink a lot is, because I don't drink the sodas. I don't drink Coke. I don't drink Pepsi. I don't, da-da-da-da-da. For obvious reasons, and I never have, except as a child. So I keep a lot of, there's many brands these days. People are switching more and more to lightly flavored, not sweetened, but, sparkling waters in cans. So I tend to keep the grapefruit flavor because I find that the most neutral. You can have flavorless ones too.
Yeah, I when I buy that, I always buy a flavor of some sort. Somehow the flavorless is just disappointing.
Right. But some of those flavors are actually, kind of yucky. Like I had one last week that said it had peach and I went, oh, this does not taste like peach. I do not like this at all. So I stick with the grapefruit ones as some of them are labeled, pamplemousse, which is the French word for grapefruit, because I find that's a really good mixture.
What a nice word. Say that again.
Pamplemousse.
Oh, very good.
Yeah. it's a good mixer for almost anything you want to drink. And I will often just put, well, the other thing is plain water with lemon, just a squeeze of fresh lemon or lime. You know, just something to give it enough flavor that you just kind of want to gobble it down. I'm a chugger, I'm afraid, you know, because that, I guess that's why I don't like hot, because you can't chug hot things. You have to sip. So I just like down the hatch kind of thing. So, you know, keeping yourself hydrated is really, really important anytime. But, you know, there's tricks and we all have habits for like our little go-tos. So those are some of the ones. Now, we were also going to talk about making syrups and things to put, like if you...
To put in some of these drinks.
Right, in sparkling waters or even in white wine or, you know, or mocktails. You know, mocktails are really big for a good reason. You know, you can drink as much of those as you like. So Lon and I both make a lot of syrups from and infusions also. Now, you can infuse some herbs too, and just like if you take lemon verbena, heat the water up, pop it in the pan, turn the heat off, close, put the lid on the pan, let it sit for a few hours, then strain it and put it in a jar in the fridge, cold, unsweetened even. Lemon verbena is really good for that. As mint, same thing you can do with that. Anise hyssop, basil, tarragon, all of those make either good herbal infusions chilled in the fridge or even what we used to call sun tea, you know, where you take the jar, put the tea or the herbs in and let them sit in the back porch in the sun. They will infuse like that. And then later, if you want to keep them in the fridge for, you know, a week or so and keep going at them, you can strain the plant material out of it. Yeah, just set it in, but you don't have to. Well, let's talk about lemon verbena. That's an old plant that both Lana and I grow. And I have to say, if you have any place to grow a plant, this would be my favorite pick. It's very pretty. And oh my goodness, does it smell good.
Mm-hmm. There are other lemony things that you in the herb department. But I think Lemon verbena is the absolute best for taste and smell. Yeah. It is the best.
Well, Lana and I dry it. Like I have a Madeline cookie recipe in one of my favorite cookbooks where you take the dried leaves and you sprinkle it into the cookie dough just before you bake it. It's heavenly. Lana's husband, Joe, gave me a Martha Stewart recipe a couple of weeks ago when we were in cherry season for making a cherry sorbet with lemon verbena in it. And those two flavors were just, didn't you love that? That was really good.
Very nice thing.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Good
thing.
Combination. Now, with the lemon verbena plants, I started growing them when I was in California, and you leave them outside all the time. But in the fall, in the late fall, you cut them way back till they're just kind of a woody structure. And then they start all over again with little tiny leaves. So here you have to bring them indoors. And that's when I cut them back. And when I cut them back, I take all the extra leaves and dry them.
Mm-hmm.
So I have two that I bring in every winter. And then I just put them in a sunny spot and water them, and they start to get little green leaves so that by the time the spring comes, they're ready to be put back out. How much do you cut yours back? How do you do it?
A whole lot. Actually, I put lemon verbena in the ground and dig it up and put it in a big pot to bring it in. And
yes, I do that too.
I cut it back quite a bit.
Do you leave any leaves on?
Oh, maybe a few around the bottom, but I cut it back. The woody stem is maybe 6 inches tall.
Cut more off the top because mine are.
Yeah, you
they're rather odd looking at this point.
Yeah, you don't need them really stringy. Right. They'll come back. They're tough.
Now, if you take all the leaves off, they still come back?
No. Leave some.
You leave a few on, right? I'm always a little scared to.
But
give them a hefty prune, right?
Yeah, give them a hefty prune. Yes, you do.
And don't expect them to look beautiful until, 5 or 6 months later.
No, they look great in the garden right now.
Oh, right now they're just beautiful. And if you're out in the garden and you even brush up against them, the smell is just heavenly.
Yes,
it really, really is one of my favorite things. So the other thing that both Lana and I bring in is, of course, the rose geranium, which is not a true geranium, but you bring them in like geraniums. You know, you kind of cut them back, put them in a sunny spot, and they start all over again. Now, I use rose geranium in a lot of things. It goes like, well, Lana's the jam and jelly maker, but I used to be, like, one of my favorite things was plum rose geranium conserve. Or jam. You just boil some of the leaves in with the fruit as you're breaking it down, basically. And then, like with the plum, I used to just do this. And we may have a good plum season then this year. We'll see. Looks good so far. If we do, I will make some rose geranium plum. So I put the plums and the rose geranium leaves in the pot to boil. And I don't even pit them, because I use that conical, my mother used to call it a ricer, but it's hers, the thing with the wooden thing that goes round and round and it pushes out through the holes. So that way the pits for plums are big enough that you feel them and you can just pull them out with your fingers after it's cooked, and it's a lot easier. But that filters out the pieces of the rose geranium too. You don't need it. But rose geranium tastes good with any acid fruit, like strawberry rose geranium is really good. Mm-hmm. Any of those things. And a rose geranium, rhubarb rose geranium. I was making a beverage out of that this spring, because rhubarb is, of course, very acidic. So to make a rose geranium rhubarb, What did I make? Was it a lemonade? Yeah. So I made the syrup. So I boiled the rhubarb down with the rose geranium, put it through the thing from my mother. So it pulls a lot of the pulp out, and you end up with a clear liquid, right? I mean, it's kind of pink. Depends on the rhubarb, right? And then I mixed it in with, I think, more sugar. I probably put sugar in the rhubarb too. But then I made like a lemonade and poured the rose syrup into it. It was really, really good. And you could make a... Actually, I think I was thinking of doing this. So there's a wedding coming up amongst my friend's children. And we want to have mocktails for the wedding. It's a non-alcoholic wedding, so we're going to buy lots of cans of probably either plain fizzy water or the pamplemousse one, right? And then I'm making different flavored syrups, and I was thinking of doing lemon verbena lemonade for one of them, and where you steep the lemonade, steep the verbena and make a sugar syrup. Well, if you're going to use lemons, pretty sweet. And then fresh lemon juice. And then you add the bubbly water to it and make it, you know, the mocktails one at a time at the mocktail table, right? And then I was going to do one with black currants. They're coming on heavy now. They're really, really good. And black currant, I was going to put something in it. Oh, this I have to go to the Asian store, but I buy yuzu marmalade, which is, they call it citron, but in Korean culture, because it comes in jars, like maybe a quart jar or something like that, and it really is yuzu, it's like orange marmalade, but it's yuzu, and so yuzu is a Japanese, almost lemon, but really something more special than lemon, right? So mixing yuzu with black currants, it's really yummy. I discovered that in an ice cream recipe a while ago. So I will go and get some of the yuzu and boil it down with the black currants. Now that will add the sugar to it from the yuzu jelly. And then I'll strain it all out so you get some of the peels and the, and that will be another syrup. And then I was thinking, what was the third one?
You had a red one.
Remember? Oh, I was going to make rose geranium. If we have enough rhubarb, there's still some rhubarb around, or what we have in the freezers, I was going to make a rose geranium rhubarb. So that was going to be for the mocktails. Now, the other ones that you can make are a basil syrup is really good. Or, and I learned this from my friend Gio, in Georgia, they make a tarragon beverage. So you infuse the tarragon with sugar and you have a tarragon syrup, and then you water it down with whatever you want. So those are really good beverage options.
Yum. Yum. Yeah, don't you, there's water, but when there's all this other good tastes around, have at it. Try some new things.
Well, and if you do want to do mocktails, something that makes it taste a little more cocktail-y, but you have to choose your mixtures carefully, using Feverfew tonic water, which is also non-alcoholic. It's good with citrus flavors and things like that, and that makes it taste more kind of special cocktail-y. Another garden herb that probably people have is anise hyssop. It's out now. It's beautiful. That makes a good syrup, too. It gives it a little licorice-y flavor. Plus, all of these syrups also can be made into sorbets for a little very light, something at the end of the meal. I would also recommend tamarind makes a good syrup, and so does hibiscus. And they're both sour a little bit. So tamarind, you can buy it at the Indian store in a big block of goop, basically. Because tamarind is, it's a pod. It comes with seeds in it. So you can buy the paste in a jar. Or if you buy the big block of goop, it's terribly inexpensive. It's quite sour and tart and makes a lovely, if you're at a taco stand, they'll be selling a soda called Tamarindo, which is a tamarind flavored. So all you do with that is you take that block of goop and you soak it in water, and it kind of busts itself up and spreads itself out, and you boil it a little bit, and then you strain all the fibers and the seeds out of it, and you've got a very sour base to make another syrup by adding sugar. And that makes I have to say, it's really good if you just take the tamarind and you add a little tequila. I'm saying a little, but it's really good. And it's very good on its own for the children. So those are some beverages that we have a lot of fun with this summer.
Good. It's always good to be hydrated. Yes, it is. Nice to have new tastes, too. I want to take this time to remind you, this is KHOI, and this is the Donalana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back. That's a little bit of a waltz called A Valse de Petite Jeune Fille, the
one
Waltz of
the my Louvre. Favorites. I love that one.
Yes, it's a lovely thing. And speaking of French waltzes, Donna, you have a new book.
Okay, it's not that new. It's from 2020, but it's on our, it goes along with our, hydration theme here for today. It's David Leibowitz, whom I always like his books. His recipes are thoughtful. He is an American chef. Actually, from the old days of Chez Panisse in Berkeley, he was a pastry chef. Then he moved to France. So for the last few years, he's been writing about all things French from an American perspective, and it's lots of fun. So he has a Substack, too, which you can subscribe to. And
David Leibovitz,
L-E-B-O-V-I-T-Z. So this book is called Drinking French, and he goes through a lot of stuff about beverages in France. So he starts with chocolate and hot coffee drinks, and you know, so he calls it the cafe drinks, what you order when you go and sit down, and whether you stand at the bar, and because if you have a coffee at the bar in France, it costs less money and you're supposed to stand up, and you're not allowed to take it to the table, because if you want to sit at the table, you have to pay a little bit more.
Well, that's only fair.
It makes sense, right? So he talks about all the habits of that, and then he talks about the drinks that you can have there. What I found really helpful in this book. Okay, let's mention cocktails. We are in a cocktail craze for the last at least 5 years, you know. And the options for making cocktails are endless and endlessly overwhelming, right? So what I used to do, I don't know, about 15 or more years ago, in Iowa, you could go on the internet to these stores, these liquor stores, like in California and New York, and you could order whatever you wanted, right? So I would go through their lists of old, if anything was described it from a recipe in 1856, I would click on that because I wanted to taste what those flavors were like. And I've had some very interesting journeys through some of these flavors, because making cocktail beverages, it's a little like cooking. You're really going with flavor and you're experimenting. But however, it's only just you open the bottle and you pour a little of this and a little of that. So it's not like a lot of prep. It's sort of interesting, quick trip for your palate. Now, the laws changed in Iowa, and now somewhere we have a list formulated of the products that can and cannot be imported into Iowa.
Oh, really?
So some of these things you can't get. So a lot of those companies stopped shipping here because there were too many prohibitions.
Huh.
So, you know, now we have to rely on our local liquor stores, some of which, and maybe the list is getting longer, because you can get things now that for a while you just couldn't get. You used to have to go to Minnesota if you wanted something exotic. So what David Leibovitz has done in this book, Drinking French, is he has gone through some of the classic French apéritifs. And he talks about aperitivo, which is what you do after you leave work and you go and sit in the cafe and unwind, right? And, you know, you don't want to get drunk because this is just the start of the evening. So one of the things I like about aperitifs is that they're usually much lower alcohol than, you know, like whiskey or something like that. And the flavors are wild, all kinds of, you know, and they're usually have a lot of bitters in them, because bitters open up the digestion, as they say, right? So it's something you want to drink before dinner to get you ready for dinner, right? You don't drink aperitifs at dinner. Sometimes you have snacks with it. So he talks about aperitifs, and then liquors and infusions, and then cocktails. And then he also puts apéro, is what they call it for short, snacks, things that you eat at the, you know, when you're having aperitifs. Now, why this book is particularly helpful is he goes through some of the classic aperitifs, like, And these are old, like from the last century mostly. These are flavors that the grandfathers used to drink. One time I was visiting my in-laws in the south of France, and they had a friend come over, and we were having a wonderful dinner, and he brought this bottle with him.
Uh-oh.
And he said, you know, my grandfather died last year, and this year we were cleaning out, you know, his cellars, basically. And in the cellar was something that was a homemade concoction. And he said, I opened it up, and when I drank it, I tasted what life was like 100 years ago. And it was an exquisite thing that, you know, I don't know what was in it. It was certainly alcoholic, because otherwise it wouldn't have lasted 100 years. It's alcohol is a preservative, but it was a homemade liquor. And a lot of these things that you can buy are based on recipes that were, you know, made in the tradition using local herbs and things like that. So with this book, he explains, like, vermouths. Vermouths are used in a lot of cocktails, and they're different. There's red vermouth, white vermouth, sweet vermouth, dry vermouth. And the different brands taste different. French vermouth is different from Italian vermouth, and there are even good Spanish vermouths. So those three countries, there's some herbal liquors from, you know, more northern countries too, but those three countries, France, Spain, and Italy, have quite a tradition of, you know, different aperos, as they would call them in France. So in this book, he talks a lot about kind of basic, you know, what vermouths do which, and also he goes into these, some of them you can buy here in Ames. So that means they're on the Iowa list. So quinquinas, which are gin-tin-based drinks, they have names like Sallers or Burr, B-U-R-H-H. So I've forgotten what the different. It's complicated, but he explains it in a way that breaks down what some of these different liquors do. So, and you know, there are a million combinations you can make with cocktails, and different flavors appeal to different people. But one thing, by kind of using this drinking French as an introduction to basically vermouths, amaros, all of these ingredients, or you can drink them straight. And I like just opening a bottle, maybe dropping an ice cube in, maybe a little bit of my pamplemousse, you know, because it doesn't change the flavor too much. It just dilutes it a little bit. And a spritz of lemon. That's my idea of, it's not a lot of alcohol. You know, you're not drinking. It's just a flavor. And, of course, Campari, which is Italian, is one of my all-time favorite bitters drinks. And it's used a lot. People know it mostly from Negronis and stuff like that.
I discovered Negronis a while ago, and I thought, what, this is, I like the bitter taste too.
Yeah,
bitter.
If you don't like bitters, you won't like it. So but if you do, it's just an exciting flavor. So I like just keeping some of these bottles around, and rather than mixing a million things with cocktails, I just drink them straight up with a little soda in them, or ice and lemon, because then you really start to understand the flavors of them.
Enjoy these
tastes. You're not getting drunk either.
Enjoy these tastes for the summer. Remember, hydrate. Say the name of the book.
Drinking French by David Leibowitz.
Good.
It's a real good introduction to not just what goes on in France, but kind of the basis for some of these cocktails that, you know, it's a sort of a contest these days. Who can make the wildest cocktails? But I like to just know the basics and stick to the classics. And also, if you don't put gin or vodka in it, it's way less alcoholic.
Very good. And you get a wonderful taste.
Yep.
So hydrate. Well, I wanted to kind of get down to earth here. We're going to talk about carrots, just a little bit about carrots, because there's a tradition in July in my household. For years, I've made my husband a birthday cake that was a carrot cake of some sort. And for years, I made the Moosewood Cookbook, the old-fashioned Molly Katzen cookbook, the carrot cake out of there. And that's always been a favorite, you know, heavy with a lot of nuts and grated carrots.
Yeah, I think I use the joy of cooking for the same way.
Nice. One thing about the Moosewood cookbook recipe is that you make it in a loaf pan.
Oh!
And And it's a nice heavy, heavy loaf thing. Mm-hmm. And you heavily butter the loaf pan and completely cover the butter by shaking poppy seeds in there. So when you unmold it, it's really pretty. It's frosted with poppy seeds.
But does she make the usual cream cheese frosting on
it? Yeah, you can make cream cheese to
go with
it.
And what does she put in her cream cheese frosting?
Oh, let's see. Oh, it's not in here.
Oh, the frosting.
All she suggests is the poppy seeds. We usually just have it with ice cream, but cream cheese is wonderful.
Well, one year I made one where I took, what's that Chilean caramel sauce? That dulce de leche. You can get them at the Mexican stores in a can. So I mixed dulce de leche with cream cheese.
Ah,
and that made a great frosting.
Good idea. Well, this year, a different carrot cake came to mind. I was given a book called Genius Desserts from the group Food 52. Genius Desserts, 100 recipes that will change the way you bake.
Yeah, and these guys are reliable. Usually Food 52 is pretty good. Yeah. As good as reliable as Moosewood and the Joy of Cooking.
So there we go.
Yeah.
I have a testimonial there. I came across this carrot cake. It said Brazilian carrot cake. And the picture doesn't look like a carrot cake at all because it's covered with drizzled semi-sweet or bitter chocolate. And those things are really good. It is made in a bundt pan and unlike...
Which is always pretty.
It's pretty. It's made in a bundt pan. And unlike other carrot cakes where you shred the carrots so you got this really chunky looking cake... You take the carrots, actually it's kind of the same ingredients, but you take the raw carrots and put them in a blender so you've got carrot mush to put in.
How about a food processor?
You could do a food processor,
too. Because do you put a liquid in it?
Yes, you put the liquid in with the carrots and go kamush, 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 and you've got the milk and eggs and three medium carrots, so you end up with mush. So it doesn't have the tooth of what you think of as a carrot cake, but it is a really nice, moist cake. And I seldom make a bun cake. I'm kind of thinking, oh, is it going to come out? Is it going to fall out? It came out just fine.
Did you grease
the pan?
Grease and flour.
And flour yep, it. And, yep. Yeah, yeah. And so it was good. It was good. I enjoyed it. And also because this recipe just was basically a carrot cake, I thought, well, it should have a little more oomph than that. So I put in a little bit. You gave me a jar of liquid cardamom.
You put cardamom in it, right.
Yes.
Oh, it's that the burlap and barrel cardamom extract.
That has been the handiest stuff.
I know.
I thought it kind of gave it a little extra.
You can use that for cocktails, too, let me tell you.
Could have done that, too. Anyway, it turned that. So that carrot cake is kind of a new tradition for carrot cake. And I also ran across some history of the carrot, and you wouldn't think a carrot would have history, but this was on the internet.
Well, they are old looking.
They've been around for a long time. The first mention of carrot is in a 10th century cookbook from Baghdad, believe it or not. They found one called the Book of Dishes, and it was mentioned in there, carrot, and then the first recorded thing of carrots as a crop were grown in Spain, and that was in the 12th century because found out these things could be, actually, people have been breeding carrot seeds for a long time. You notice which ones did really good, and they realized you could grow them, especially in light, sandy soil, and they kept well. People liked carrots.
Well, there are a lot of wild carrot relatives. They must have had a time sorting that all out. Like Queen Anne's laces. Right. Isn't that a carrot relative?
And they have roots underneath too. So finding these carrots, they came pretty much out of the Middle East. People were dealing with that. And they came in different colors. And they were referred to as red, white, or yellow carrots. Believe it or not, orange as a concept, orange as a color, was kind of a new thing. It wasn't until the 16th century that the the fruit, oranges, found their way to Europe. And okay, there's orange, so that's a new color. There it is. And also, long about that time, the latest fad, they had fads back then, the clothing of Margaret Tudor, the Scottish queen, she favored the color.
Orange, really. Right, because red or purple was always favored by royalty because those early dyes were, those were the most precious, rare dyes. So only the really, you know, top of the economic pile could have those colors.
Anyway, that orange was kind of the latest thing, and it went up into Flanders, and Dutch breeders. It somehow carrots did really well there.
I wonder if they used it from saffron.
I don't know how they dyed things back then.
Orange, right.
But there it is. The Persian word for orange was narang, N-A-R-A-N-G, and by the time it got to Spain and into Northern Europe, they kind of tried to say the word narang, and old French was more orange. So that and that was in
Spanish, isn't it narengo or something?
Okay. Anyway, here was this new fruit, and guess what? All of this breeding that happened with the carrots up in northern Europe.
Right, because they weren't growing oranges up there.
All of a sudden, this orange variety came out. Everybody liked it because it lasted a long time. And oranges were used primarily for sweets. We didn't have sugar cane and things like that. It was a sweet vegetable that could be used for...
Oh, carrots were.
Carrots were for jams, and this is before oranges got there. And they lasted a long time. They made puddings out of it. Carrots were
Carrot
cake, a really big deal. So Dutch breeders worked on carrot breeding, and even in the...
Well, they must have been breeding for higher sugars, too.
Higher sugars, and so they got oranger and oranger, although the... Other colors of carrots still exist. You can find them elsewhere. And one thing about carrots, they are a biennial. One year they make a root. The next year, if you leave it in the ground, they make seeds. So people figured that out. But that would even happen with ours. So we have lots of carrot. Orange carrots seem to be the thing now. But there we go. A little history of the carrot. Who knew? Oranges. And carrots, kind of, oranges gave their name to an orange carrot. You had they weren't just red carrots anymore or yellow carrots. There's orange carrots. There we go.
And carrot juice.
And carrot juice. Hydrate, folks, hydrate. You're listening to KHOI. You can find out more at www.khoifm.org. Okay, we have some other thoughts on summer here. There's a few things to think about elderberries. Coming into ripeness this time of year is all kinds of berries, and I'd like to take a little minute here to talk about elderberries. Elderberries, they are a very, very hardy, grow almost any place, bush that grows in Iowa in road ditches.
And they get big.
Mine are big.
Maybe 10 or 12 feet tall.
One of those things that's so healthy and so good for you, and they take care of themselves. They grow wild, and we forget that this sort of thing grows wild. You can make wonderful things out of elderberries. You can just use the juice. I love making elderberry jelly. You can use the blossoms.
Well, we're in the blossom season right now, actually towards the end of it. They're really pretty. They're called umbrellas.
Yeah,
like because umbrella. They look like little flower umbrellas.
Mm-hmm. And so if you see these bushes on the side of the road with these beautiful multi-blossomed fuzzy
white,
gorgeous things.
Now, they're not hydrangeas.
Different thing altogether.
Okay, elderberries are taller.
Yes, and have...
And wild.
Yes, and have very pointed multiple leaves. And one can, I've heard of actually frying these blossoms. I have never done that.
Me either.
That sounds pretty exotic.
It sounds a little fussy to me. I don't need, you know, they're so delicate.
But the blossoms also have a very unique, delicate taste, so you can infuse those blossoms in things.
Isn't Joe doing some elderberry infusion?
Oh, my husband got on the internet and got all excited.
So tell us what he's doing. You have any idea?
Well, like you talked about the blackcurrant
leaf
cordial.
Uh-huh.
This is putting elderberry blossoms, infusing it
straight
in some
into vodka.
Yes,
and that's it. Sugar or no?
Knowing him, I'm sure he didn't put any sugar, but I think he did put a little lemon juice in with, or lemon peel.
Uh-huh.
And it's supposed to sit for a while, and that smell comes out. You wouldn't think these delicate little flowers would do anything, but there they are. They are
gorgeous.
Well, there
is that Saint Germain elder blossom liqueur, which has become popular recently. It is delicious, especially as an addition to cocktails. So,
very good. Well, I mentioned jelly and the berries come out, and you can harvest a whole lot. That's one nice thing about elderberries. You can get quantities with a scissors and a pair of some clothes that you don't mind getting purple and going through the brush a little bit for. But they don't have thorns. They don't have, so that's good. I have a little bit of thing I want to read for you here. Thanks to Mark Edwards for passing along this book. I'm borrowing it from him. It's called The Global Forest by Diana Beresford Kroger. And she writes about, she loves trees. She loves forests. And she writes beautifully about trees and forests. Here's a little bit about elderberries. And she puts it in a category, a little chapter here about magical trees. Magical trees and mystical forests are as old as Father Time. Magic is known and recognized worldwide, both in the past and in the present. The word itself is very old and arises with the birth of civilization. It comes from the old Persian word magus, meaning sorcerer. Some trees of our global garden fit the bill of being magical. One of these is the elderberry. Sambucus is its name. It has long been considered to hold magic. This knowledge was held parallel in time by different cultures of old and new worlds. It was known in China, Japan, as well as Russia. The elderberry was a favorite in the heady days of Egyptians and remained in continuous use to modern times. In Northern Europe, many people would never pass an elderberry without greeting the tree, either in word or deed. They would doff their hat and bow in respect. The species was never burned or never destroyed because it was believed that the souls who lived in an elderberry bush would then be destroyed. It did not go unnoticed that the elderberry is never touched by insects or destroyed by disease. The elderberry does have extraordinary powers. In ancient Egypt, it was used as a valuable cosmetic. Its effects on the skin are rejuvenation and revitalization. The flowers were popular as an infusion for an eye lotion and to rejuvenate weary eyes. Native American peoples used the elderberry on their premature and newborn babies. These babies were washed in a lukewarm water of which, dried elderberry flowers had been soaked.
The flowers.
The flowers. The warm waters contain capillary protective biochemicals that act as a gentle skin tonic through vasodilation on the newborn skin. And probably one of the most important biochemicals is in the mature black fruit of the elderberry is a rhamnose sugar complex. It increases the efficiency of the metabolism of the eye, particularly the avian eye, adding visual acuity in the transition zones between dark and light.
Yes, the birds do eat the elderberry.
That's it.
Not the insects, but the birds.
That's why. The sugar is much sought after by songbirds in their north to south migrations in the global garden. And this elderberry was often called the medicine chest of country people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because like I mentioned before, the water is good for the eye. Elderflower water is good for the complexion and the eyes. And the flowers are also used to treat burns and bruises. And the berries are rich in vitamin C and have for centuries have been used for jellies, cordials, wines.
It's also a cold remedy. Like, yes, you can buy Sambucol at the drugstore, at the health food store. That's elderberry syrup for colds.
Very good. So doff your hat to the next time you pass an elderberry bush.
Well, we're going to get into the season for the berries pretty soon. And they do have a beautiful color. However, the taste is a little metallic. So when you make elderberry jelly, what are you putting with it?
Oh, always put some lemon juice in for sure. You have to temper elderberry with lemon juice. But I also like to mix it with apple or some other.
I've done
kind
it with
of,
plums,
yes,
with raspberry.
Add
any acidic fruit,
yes,
will kind of
wake
perk it up.
Yeah. Wake it up. Yes. Yes. Good. That's a little bit of little thoughts about elderberries from the Donalana Kitchen archives.
Well, also in the Drinking French cookbook with a book by David Leibovitz, there is an elderflower cordial. This is non-alcoholic. So you take it's flowers. He says you do not rinse the flowers because you'll lose the flavor. He said if there's any loose dust or bugs, you just kind of flick them off, and then you pull the flowers gently into a bowl off of the umbrella. So you don't want the stems or anything that you just, and there's a beautiful picture of the flowers floating in a little pan. So he mixes it with 4 cups of water, 3.5 cups of sugar, or 3 1/4, sorry, 3 lemons. So you've got to put some lemon in there, thinly sliced, 2 cups of fresh elder flowers, about 25 heads. That takes a lot. And then he adds a tablespoon of citric acid, which will give it a little bite. And then you just heat it together and store it, you know, after it's cooked, transfer the liquid to a large measuring cup or container with a spout for easy pouring. Put it into clean, tightly corked bottles and put it into the refrigerator. Can be kept for up to a year. So this is just the non-alcoholic version. You can also add it to white wine and, you know, store it that way. Elderflower wine or a elderflower French champagne cocktail. So those instructions are in Drinking French by David Leibovitz.
Ah, very good. So that was one book we talked about today. We also referred to the Moosewood cookbook. My copy is kind of falling apart, but there it is. How did we ever get through the 60s and 70s without the Moosewood cookbook? And then Food 52, Genius Desserts, another good source of information. Yes. Well, thanks for being with us at our kitchen table today. Donna, tell folks about our website.
The podcast?
I mean the website.
The podcast, yeah, right. The website. We only are on the KHOI website, but the podcast can be listened to anywhere you listen to podcasts. Just type in Donalana, that's one word, Donalonna, kitchen, and there you will find us.
Good, good. Well, there's lots of summer left to enjoy. There's PFI field days going on. You can go to the PFI
and the corn has come in, and the tomatoes are still ahead of us.
Oh, I'm looking forward to that. I've had a bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwich.
But, you did already.
But my bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwich I made with a bunch of cherry tomatoes.
Okay, all right. That's not quite a BLT.
Not quite. Okay. It was tasty, but it wasn't the big sloppy kind. But I enjoyed it anyway. That's very good. And the State Fair is coming up, too. We hope the good weather holds for the State Fair. Instead of getting so beastly hot, we'll see. We've had fine weather. Yes. You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. We come to you every Tuesday here on this fine radio station. We are heard 7 o'clock in the evening if you miss the noontime airing of the show. Go to the KHOI website to find us there with a lot more information. We had music by the Barn Owl Band today. You heard the Waltz of the Little Girls, and we'll go out with a tune called Mandalude. Yes, yes. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had excellent engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.